Buying or selling your home? Real Estate for Life can connect you with a pro-life real estate agent. When Real Estate for Life receives a referral fee, they donate 65% to Catholic Answers. Learn more at realestateforlife.org. Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. As promised, Dr. Matthew Bunsen is our guest from EWTN, where he runs the news department for EWTN. And also, I know many people, and I among them, the first hearing of the new pope was an American. It was because he exclaimed that on the air, the first American pope. And now he has a book out, Pope Leo XIV, Portrait of the First American Pope. And I mean out. It's not about to be out. It's out from from EWTN Press. Is that
it is correct. EWTN Publishing.
EWTN Publishing. Dr. Matthew Bunsen.
And hello, by the way.
Hello. Thank you for being here with us.
It's great to be with you. I don't think we've actually talked since the conclave, have we?
No. And I want to tell you, I was about 20 miles from here doing an interview with Archbishop Corleone.
Yeah.
And then in the midst of the interview, somebody said white smoke. And for some reason, I thought they were telling me that something was on fire. It did not even connect. And then, so we talked about, I just asked him some questions about it. I didn't ask him, who do you think it's going to be? Because we're still a couple hours away or something. And
right.
Like, he's not going to want to answer that. then I got in the car and I tried to be back here in this building because I wanted to be with everybody here at Catholic Answers when we found out who the new Pope was. And I couldn't make it. I couldn't get here. So I was listening to you, and you were in the square there, and all the reporting you had going on, and all of that.
Right.
And then I heard you gave kind of a description. One of the three of you, it was a three-person panel, a description of what was going to be said. You gave a description. So I'm listening for this, and I hear in Latin, and I think it's like Robertum Franciscum.
Robertum.
Yes. And I was like, Robert Francis? Who's that? And I didn't know there was going to be like a little another statement, and then they would say the last name. So I was thinking, who is Robert Francis? And then I heard you say our first American pope. And I was like, what is going on? Like, my head exploded. I was like,
You're thinking you'd wandered into a TV show.
What's happening over there in Rome? It's the craziest thing. So that's what the moment was like for me. But you informed me. And then I was like, oh, and you were very prepared. I was like, nobody else knows who this guy is, but Matt Bunsen knows who he is. So tell me a little bit about that. How do you prepare for a moment like that? What was it like to be there when that happened?
Well, obviously, to have a front row to history is something. It's something you'll always remember. But to have a front row to a conclave, because this is not just a journalistic moment, it's not just a broadcast moment, but this is our faith.
And this is
for us, the election of a new Supreme Pontiff. So it has all of those layers of complexity, but also of immense privilege to be there. It's such an honor to be a participant in something like that. And you're right. Here we were. We had anticipated that it might go an extra day, maybe. Then there was some potential confusion because the vote would normally, if you know how the system works, so they obviously did their two votes in the morning. We had black smoke. And then they went to lunch for pranzo. Then they came back, and there seemed to be a very long stretch. So we started to assume that the fourth vote of the conclave, or in the third vote of the day, was inconclusive, which means that they set the ballots aside and then they go immediately to another vote. So we were thinking, okay, so the fifth vote would be later, so probably around 6 o'clock or 7 o'clock. And then sure enough, I said a couple of times, trust the seagulls, because, you know, there were seagulls all over the smokestack, the chimney. And smoke started billowing out, and they all ran for it, including this adorable little baby seagull. And it, sure enough, was white smoke. So there we were. So basically, it was the fourth ballot of the conclave, which is the number of ballots that it took for the election of Joseph Ratzinger.
Right.
So that gives you an idea of how fast this was. It was
really
five
fast.
Ballots for Jorge Mario Bergoglio in 2013.
Right.
So a full extra vote. So whatever they decided in those general congregations, and we can talk more about that, they went to lunch and basically came back and he went over the top. And you're right. So we had that incredible moment that accompanies every election. Annuntio vobis gaudium magnum, you know.
Yeah.
I bring you great joy. Habemus papam, and everyone goes crazy. And then he starts reading, and all of us had the names of the likely cardinals of papabili, and Robert Francis Prevost was on that list. But then you hear reverendissimum, eminentissimum, and then he says Robertum. Now, there was a nanosecond where I was thinking, could they have possibly have elected Cardinal Robert Sarra, because he's obviously a very popular figure with many, many Catholics around the world.
Right, right.
And then I heard Franciscum. So we had the list. And what was funny about the list is that the names were all in the accusative case in Latin, because you know, Latin has a lot of declensions. And so there, sure enough, Robertum, and then Cardinalium Prevost. And I had a pretty good idea when I heard Robert Francis that it had to be Prevost because that was his name. How many Robert Francis's can there be? But to be there for that moment, the intensity of it, but also the spirituality, the prayer aspect of that, the spiritual dimensions of that really can't be underestimated. And you could see it in the crowd. You could feel it in the square. And I said at the time that all of the networks were surrounding us because we were up on a series of sets, as they were the ones who would declare that religion's irrelevant, that the Catholic Church is passé.
Right, right.
That just doesn't matter anymore. And I looked around me, and I actually
They're
said
all there.
At one point on the air, they keep telling us that we're irrelevant, and yet here they are scrambling to get on the air to announce right. who the new Pope is.
Right, right. Wow, it really extraordinary, exciting moment. But you weren't entirely shocked that it was Robert Prevost. I have to say, I was entirely shocked. I didn't know who you were talking about when you started talking about it. But you were not entirely shocked.
No. Well, for a couple of reasons. The first was that really for some months, he was, as they say, plucked out of seeming obscurity in 2023 by Pope Francis and installed as the head of one of the most important Vatican offices, which is the Dicastery for Bishops, as its prefect. And then in short order, too, in just a couple of months, he was made a cardinal. So that tells you something about him, that certainly Pope Francis had great trust in him. This was the Bishop of Chiclayo in Peru. It had the interesting side story, as it turns out, that he was also from Chicago. But he'd been gone for many, many years. He'd been a missionary in Peru and all of that. We can talk more about his bio in a second. But then I flew out on the 21st, the day that Pope Francis passed away, landed in Rome on the 22nd. And within a few days, in talking with the various people that I knew, Vaticanisti experts and various prelates of a wide variety of ranks, his name would pop up from time to time. And the question was always asked, well, what do you hear about Cardinal Prevost? And I would ask, you know, what have you heard about Cardinal Prevost? And one of the things that we kept coming back to, I noticed, is that I would hear, well, he is eminently qualified to be elected pope, and he would be at the very top of any list of papabili, except he has the insurmountable obstacle of being an American.
Yeah.
And as they said, everyone knows that an American cannot get elected pope.
Right. And so I have to say that's part of why I think, because I had seen the names, and I remember reading, you know, whoever's list would be, you know, everybody's got a list. That
everybody
they put
has
out.
A list, yes.
And there's certain names that are always on it, you know, that certain cardinals that, okay, they're going to be on all the lists. And I think I honestly mentally just skipped over Prevost every time. I think I just, like I was really reading about each one, trying to get a feel. Is this the guy? But Prevost, mm-hmm. I think I just went right past him thinking, well, obviously that's not the guy. Like, he's an American. Right. There's no way.
Right. Right. So, and it was a reasonable assumption to make.
Yeah. Why is that? Why do we assume that no American would be the Pope? Where does that come from?
Yeah, I think it's partly a longstanding set of assumptions. Mm-hmm. I in thinking about it, I realize there are probably two major ones, though. The first is that the United States remains arguably the world's greatest superpower. Mm-hmm. And I think it was Bishop Robert Barron at one point, we had him on as a guest, and he said that the late, great, and holy Cardinal Francis George once made the observation that an American could be elected if America had declined as a superpower. Mm-hmm. Personally, I don't think that has happened because there was always this assumption that it would be an American cardinal from one of the great American sees. Yeah. And certainly we have a number of very eminent cardinals right now who are in the college. But the America as this, it isn't simply a massive military power. It isn't simply an economic power, but it is also a great cultural power. It is a superpower for media and influence and shaping of global culture. Anyone who spends time on social media can see that. So there's that. And I think one of the assumptions has always been that they would not elect an American simply because it would be perceived as the American takeover of the papacy.
One more thing. Yeah.
One more thing, right.
Right.
And then there'd be the questions of, well, would there be divided loyalties and all? I mean, basically completely wrong assumptions on multiple fronts. But then there's also something else that historically, we are by definition and really just by the sheer duration of the history of the church, a church that's 2,000 years old. The church in the United States is very young compared to that.
Yes.
It was only in 1908 that the United States was lifted from missionary status, for example.
I know.
And sort of set off on its own path, no longer needing sort of the close supervision of what was then the propaganda fide. So there was just something of an assumption that even though there were some very remarkable prelates in certainly throughout the 20th century, America was just too young to produce a pope.
Yeah.
Both of those assumptions turned out not just to be wrong, but at the end of the day, they just didn't matter as far as the members of the college who were voting in the Sistine Chapel.
We have to take a break. When we come back, by the way, you're welcome to call. If you'd like to talk with Dr. Bunsen, you're welcome to call. Ask your questions about the church in the news. There's, as always, lots of Catholic, or there's lots of news of the Catholic Church. And so if you have something else you'd like to talk about, maybe something you have seen covered on EWTN News or in one of the other outlets of EWTN, like the National Catholic Register or Catholic News Association, whatever you may, wherever you may have read the news, if you'd like to ask a question, you're welcome to. Or maybe you've got a question about what it's like to be in Rome when they elect a pope or how they cover that kind of news, your call is welcome. But I do want to ask you when we come back about some of the things that the cardinals said after. Because mm-hmm. I was very interested. The American cardinals came out and they were quite chatty about the whole thing. And I don't think in a way
they
didn't violate their oath. At least it didn't seem to me. But they were perfectly willing to talk about it. Mm-hmm. And I think they were surprised that an American was elected as well. But it was interesting to hear their take from inside the conclave. So we'll take a quick break. We'll be right back with more. Dr. Matthew Bunsen from EWTN, and you're welcome to call 888-318-7884.
There's only one Catholic Answers Live.
Are you a coffee drinker? If so, you can now enjoy a coffee roasted to perfection by the Carmelite monks of Wyoming. Delicious Mystic Monk coffee is roasted and prepared by monks in a hidden cloistered monastery and is available in over 25 varieties. All Mystic Monk coffees are works of perfection and labors of love. For more information on how to purchase Mystic Monk coffee, visit mysticmonkcoffee.com. That's mysticmonkcoffee.com.
Proclaiming the faith, changing lives. The year was 2015. EWTN opens its West Coast studio on the campus of Christ Cathedral in Orange, California, enabling EWTN to produce new programming that will bring the people and the stories of the faith that make up the church in Southern California to our global audience.
To learn more about Mother Angelica's life and the history of EWTN, visit EWTN.com/Mother Angelica.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. I just found out millions of people listened to Dr. Bunsen's call of the new Pope on EWTN around the world. You were just saying, just before we came back on, it's a huge number. 3 million people, 3 million devices.
Just on YouTube. Just on YouTube.
Just on YouTube. So you really don't know how many people were watching or listening at that time.
No.
And
that's exactly right. Now, it tells you something about the deep fascination that people had across the board for information and details about what was happening in Rome. We saw that throughout the interregnum. We were averaging about 1 million for a number of those days, 2 million for like his installation mass. You can go to YouTube and you can take a look at the numbers, which is absolutely astonishing. But that's just for YouTube.
Wow.
Now, when you look at various other platforms that we're on, this was a phenomenal moment. But it tells you that people were coming to us in part because they were tired in many ways of the secular coverage of these types of events.
That's
they
why
really
I was there.
Frustrated.
I just didn't want to hear what the secular, because it's so formula in a certain way. Is he the left wing guy? Is he the right wing guy?
Right.
Is he going to allow, whatever their thing is. Is he going to
exactly.
allow, and then fill in the blank with whatever their thing is, women priests or gay marriage or just.
Right.
And you just go, this has nothing to do with what's actually happening in Rome. So I wanted to hear
some
people that understood that.
The other thing, too, is that it's so easy to forget. Yes, a conclave is a juridical act. It is an event of it comes down to a vote. There is an election. But there's so much more to it than that, of who they're electing as the vicar of Christ, as the bishop of Rome, the successor of St. Peter. So you really want to try to find coverage that respects that, but also tries to unpack so much of that theologically and spiritually and even canonically and liturgically. And I think I know I heard from a lot of people who are just very frustrated with this time around in particular, because I think we've seen such fragmentation in media across the board that they've gotten rid of a lot of the seasoned hands who might actually have known something more than just is it a horse race and is the next Pope going to ordain women priests?
Yeah.
I mean, I had the feeling sometimes that was what it was like.
Right. And it's also those seasoned hands were seasoned because there were people who formed them. And you look at some of the anchors and hosts on television, and they've been very poorly formed. And I think they've been poorly formed in the habits of journalism because they came up in journalism in the age of clicks. And they were told, they weren't told, take your time, get the story right, be fair to everybody. That's not what they were told. They were told, you're lagging these 10 people in clicks, you need to beat them.
Now, in fairness too, that doesn't in any way remove the fascination. There was at any given time about 4,000 number. That was the number accredited journalists working in Rome.
Yeah.
And there were days where I always joke that we had the break between Pope Francis's funeral and then we had the Novendialis, the 9 days of mourning, and then into the conclave. And a lot of the outfits and outlets sort of packed up, went home, and then came back just for the conclave. But those who stayed, they were really struggling to report because for them, it's all about the horse race and other things. And I even joked to some of our people in Rome that, well, we know that it's getting difficult for them when they start interviewing each other. Sure enough,
there
that's
what
was happening.
Yeah. like when you're watching a football game and one team's blowing the other team out by 60 points or something, that's when you go, okay, let's see how good these broadcasters are. Like you can't tell how good they are when the game is close. But when there's an hour to fill. You know, we got three more quarters of this game, and we all know who's going to win.
And it's 45 to nothing.
So that's what I was thinking with the three of you. And your co-hosts were Monsi Alvarado.
That's correct. President of News.
And Monsignor...
Roger
Landry.
Yeah, and he's the National Director of the Pontifical Mission Societies here in the U.S. And both of them were just tremendous to work with.
That's what I thought, because I think, okay, we've had the white smoke, but now these three know, well, we've got 2 hours at least that we're going to be sitting here. You have to say something for those 2 hours. And you were giving a great deal of insight, you know, the historical insight and reflecting on previous, also helping people to know who the papable, how do you say it?
Papabili.
You say it that way. That's fine. I can't say that. Papabili. I guess I can say it.
Let's just say the leading candidate.
Yeah, the leading candidates. It was very well done. It was a really good, solid broadcast. And that's when you're good at it if you can fill that long period of and uncertain period of time. You just don't know when they're coming out. But let me ask you this.
A lot of variables like when the smoke will come out and
At least you could tell it was white smoke this time, because in some previous they couldn't tell. Was that white? I don't know. It was smoke. I don't know what that was. But from where you're sitting, what can you see? Can you see after the white smoke, people, I would assume some are running, some are walking into the square.
Yes.
What do you see from where you're sitting at the EWTN booth there?
Yeah, so the way to think of it is that if you're facing St. Peter's, we were to the right, that's sort of the bottom of the St. Peter's Square.
Okay.
So it'd be, you know, had the arms sort of come out. So if you're facing it, we were to the right. And from our vantage point, we had this, you saw the shot. It's a gorgeous shot of St. Peter's in the square. Now, the problem is, of course, is you're sort of facing away from the square because you're facing the cameras. And so we were relying on various monitors to tell us exactly what was happening. For example, when the white smoke hit, we were on set and more or less ready to go, but you still have to get set and get onto the air. So we were watching the white smoke through what they call the chimney cam, which everyone was watching at that point, courtesy of the Vatican. And so the Vatican feed itself, and I have to give a lot of credit, first to the Sala Stampa, which is the Vatican press office, for handling 4,000 accreditations as they did. And then also introducing some really interesting innovations. Back in 2013, we had the actual procession into the Sistine Chapel, which a number of people posted on X that there are no aesthetics like Catholic aesthetics, and they're absolutely right. The images, for example, of those cardinals processing into the Sistine beneath the gaze of Our Lord in the Last Judgment by Michelangelo and taking their oaths as they prepared to vote. I mean, those are just astounding images.
Right.
But all credit goes to the CTV, to the Vatican television and that outfit for having the wherewithal to realize the significance of this and the interest in this around the world. And they also had drones that were maneuvering around St. Peter's Square. So that's why we had some really gorgeous shots, especially for the Annuncio Vobis and then when Pope Leo came out. So it's always a question, too, of what cutting to what's important and making those decisions. And I think that's where we are blessed with our production team, because they understood where to go. Where to look and you know, what we need to do to give everyone a broadcast that's worthwhile. Thank you for your compliments, but it's a lot of people who helped put this together, both on television and radio. I think that's somewhat underappreciated, how important radio was in a moment like this.
You said that the word was that there was the only thing that the people were saying was a mark against Prevost was he's American.
That's right.
But you also something in you kind of knew there was still a real possibility for him. I freely admit I totally blew that. I just ignored him.
That's completely understandable.
But you didn't, though. You were kind of not shocked. So tell me about that.
Yeah. So as I was saying, that really from the time that I arrived, you know, his name was percolating. His name was out there, and we had a fairly impressive list of the so-called papabili. You know, these are prelates. Think of Cardinal Pietro Parolin, the Vatican Secretary of State, who went in basically as a heavy favorite In a similar way to Cardinal Angelo Scola, who's a name that most people have forgotten. In 2013, he was considered to be a heavy favorite going in. And so my question, I had two questions for friends. I said, one, who is the Scola, the Cardinal Scola of this conclave? In other words, who's a heavy favorite who may not be as strong as people think? Mm-hmm. And then who is a Bergoglio? Because no one saw Cardinal Bergoglio coming in 2013.
No.
And the second question is a little more difficult, but I began more and more thinking, and I have witnesses for this in case people doubt this, I really began thinking more and more that Cardinal Prevost was this Bergoglio who had this an undergirding of support that a lot of people weren't necessarily seeing because of those understandable assumptions. And I will say that in about 3 days before the conclave started, I had his biography and other information about him on my phone, just because I thought he's an interesting individual. He ticks all of those boxes that the cardinals had been talking about in their so-called general congregations, the lead up to the conclave itself. But again, he was an American. So if, however, he wasn't elected, I'm still to some benefit for having studied so many of these cardinals, him included. But if he was elected, then I think that we were able to have some insight into who he was, but also why he was picked, because I think that's always so important. And yeah. What was it about him that the cardinals saw?
Let's talk more about that when we come back, and we'll get to some calls. You're very welcome to call if you have questions for Dr. Matthew Bunsen, 888-318-7884. I also want to talk a little bit more about the book, Pope Leo the 14th, Portrait of the First American Pope, out now from EWTN Publishing. Right back with more Dr. Matthew Bunsen on Catholic Answers Live.
Deepen your connection to the Church's holy days and seasons while you draw on the wisdom of the Church Fathers. Feasts of Our Fathers, the new book from Mike Aquilina and Adam Lucas, is a treasury of history, prayers, insights, and lessons that will bring you closer to the earliest of Catholic traditions. Take your prayer life and your solidarity with the Church, past and present, to a new level. Order your copy of Feasts of Our Fathers today at shop.catholic.com.
We hope that one of the things that we communicate here at Catholic Answers Live is that our Catholic faith allows us to be fully serious about all the problems we encounter in the church and in the world, but it also lets us have light hearts and maybe even mix in a bit of fun. And that is exactly what our good friend Joe Heschmeyer does in his popular podcast, Shameless Popery. You should check it out at shamelessjoe.com. Joe's got a deep grasp of the faith, of morals, the teachings of the church, all that, but he's also got a witty conversational style. He entertains and he informs, but you will leave equipped to better answer the most common challenges, misconceptions, and questions about the Catholic faith. He's got insightful guests, he does on-air debates, and he takes a close look into all the things that you want to know about as a Catholic living today. You'll walk away knowledgeable and filled with joy. Look for Joe on his YouTube channel. Check him out at shamelessjoe.com or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you like what you hear, become a patron.
Our Lord needs articulate defenders of the truth to spread the joy of the Catholic faith. Catholic Answers Monthly Giving Club, Society 315, helps you fulfill the call in 1 Peter 3:15 to always be prepared to make a defense for the hope that is in you. For as little as $10 a month, you'll help Catholics grow in faith, bring lapsed Catholics home, and lead non-Catholics to the truth. Go to CASociety315.com and join today.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. I'm Cy Kellett, your host. Dr. Matthew Bunsen is our guest. And you know him from EWTN, and where he runs the news department for the EWTN networks and also their print news. It's all under his purview. He has a new book, Leo the 14th, Portrait of the First American Pope, out now. Do check it out if you want to learn about our new pope. Two things, and I will let people know that you can still call 888-318-7884. And I've been I've been actually enjoying talking with Dr. Bunsen, but I will get some phone calls in here. two maybe relatively quick questions. You speak Italian fluently, and so he comes out and he spoke in Spanish and Italian. I don't know if you speak Spanish, but what were your impressions of him and his remarks as he stood there addressing the Italian or the Romans and people from around the world?
Yeah. Yeah, I would say first, my Italian is passable.
Okay, passabile, passabile.
just in full disclosure.
Okay,
it's always better by the time I leave.
You just spent what, 5 weeks in Rome?
Five weeks.
So you better be better after 5 weeks.
Yeah, no, it was a very interesting moment because I think it was very revealing too. He spoke three languages on the loggia. Latin, which one expects, Italian, which one also expects. He is, after all, just elected the Bishop of Rome. And this is the language of his flock now. Obviously, he's a universal pastor, but in terms of the day-to-day, it's going to be Italian. And then, as you noted, he spoke Spanish, and he gave a shout-out to his old diocese of Chiclayo in Peru. And it was... A lot of people had a few eyebrows raised that, okay, he's the first U.S.-born pope in church history. 2,000 years, we've never had one. Why didn't he speak English? And I think it's a fair question because I think he is somebody who understood the intensity of this moment. But I think he did it for two reasons. And obviously, I do not speak for Pope Leo XIV, but I think he understood the significance of the fact that, yes, he was the first U.S.-born pope. So coming out right out of the gate speaking English, I'm not sure if it necessarily would be the kind of thing that you want to project right from the start for all of those reasons that we were just talking about a little while ago.
All right.
But he spoke Spanish because it was truly from his heart, and he loves Peru. That's very clear. He spent decades there as a missionary. He spent more than about a decade there, or almost a decade there, as a bishop in Chiclayo, in his diocese. They loved him. The Peruvians considered him as much a Peruvian, Peruano, as Americans consider him an American. And they have really taken ownership of him. And he's a naturalized citizen of Peru, which is one of the requirements to be a bishop. But I think he came by it naturally. And this is something that he just really, loves Peru. So this was a real statement of affection on his part. But then he did something very smart. The next morning, when he goes to the Sistine Chapel and he says Mass with the cardinals who had just elected him, what, 24 hours before, he starts with this impromptu little series of comments in English.
Right, right.
And so he was laying down a series of markers that, yes, I am an American and you're going to hear English. And it's been really interesting to watch him speak English in different settings now, to different events and to different groups, like at his general audience. He will read the English summary in English by himself and to hear him. Yeah. As a friend who works in Rome said, this is the first time that we've heard English from their standpoint with an accent. And in this case, it's an American accent.
Right. But we hear it with no accent.
We hear it with no accent,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And that's jarring for a lot of people, and I completely sympathize.
I still find it weird. It's very strange. The other thing I wanted to ask you about, because I had mentioned it before, the American cardinals came out and they, not all of them, there were a couple missing. I can't remember who was missing, but there was a good panel of the American cardinals who came out.
At the North American College.
Yeah. And they were very candid in their talking about it. And I can't remember if it was Cardinal Supich or McElroy, but one of them. The reporters really wanted to find, what reporters do. They want to find the controversial point. They want that.
Right.
And they kept pushing him on the American thing. And I think it might have been Cardinal McElroy said, there was a point at which nobody cared that he was an American. He was, they had kind of come around to, this is the guy. He has all the qualities, and it had nothing to do. Like I think I think it was the question had a little Trump in it. It was something about the way of the cardinals. I don't know, standing up to the Trump administration or something.
Right.
Which is a really silly question. But the way that it was answered was like, it wasn't like, well, maybe there's a little, it was like, no, this had nothing. It was like, this guy was clearly coming across as this is the guy. And then nobody cared that he was an American.
Right. That's exactly right. And I think it was Cardinal Daniel DiNardo, the Archbishop Emeritus of Galveston, Houston, who had a really important comment. He said that in the eyes of so many of the cardinals, especially at the end, he was really more of a universal figure. Yes, yeah. He was born in just near Chicago. And the reality is, though, that he'd been gone for decades. He had served in Peru as the head of the Augustinian order. He had traveled the world.
Yeah.
He'd been to country after country. And then as the prefect for the Dicastery for Bishops, he dealt with many cardinals and bishops around the world. So he was, I guess one way of putting it is that he's certainly not un-American. He clearly loves America. He loves his homeland. But he's, you could argue, that one way to say it is he's the least American of all of the potential American cardinals.
Yeah.
Because he was gone for so long. And there were, my understanding is, that a number of cardinals, when they arrived, they knew of him, but they didn't really know much about him. And there were a few who weren't even aware that he was an American in that sense. So I think it's a really interesting reality that because he'd been gone for so long, but also because he's such a quintessential example of what a great missionary can achieve, that he just did not come across as American. And being fluent as he is in Italian, in Spanish, of course, in Portuguese and French, he knows some German, he knows Latin, he can do Greek. He is a polyglot. And I think that also factored in very heavily into some of their decision making.
Because for Francis, for whatever he had, the many gifts that he had, he was not a polyglot. He was he struggled with any language outside of Spanish and Italian.
That's right. Yeah, he spoke English to Congress in 2015 when he came on that very historic visit for the canonization of Junipero Serra, and he spoke to Congress, as I was saying. But you're right, it wasn't quite the same thing. You go back to somebody like Benedict XVI, I think he spoke 9 or 10 languages. John Paul II, I think by the end, because he was learning them as he was Pope, I think it was about 20. He was passable in things like Vietnamese. So I think that Cardinal Prevost brought, he brings to the table these gifts. And I think that was a real factor in this. But then there was also, I was talking about in these general congregations, they were listing some of the things that the church needs at this moment and then reflecting on who really might be the most qualified person to succeed Pope Francis. And they had things like the law.
Right.
A lot of things are unsettled in terms of motu proprio from Pope Francis. And that's not a criticism. It's just, he issued 75 or more motu proprio. Altering church law, which is entirely his right to do according to his vision for what was needed, but a lot of questions have emerged from those decisions. So they wanted somebody who was an expert in law. Well, Cardinal Prevost has a doctorate in canon law from the Angelicum in Rome.
I know.
They wanted somebody who had missionary zeal. Well, it's hard to find. It's funny you should add.
Yeah.
Somebody who's a very capable administrator.
Right.
And he has shown that. Somebody also who can build bridges, who can sort of bring people together. And one of the great hallmarks of his time as head of the Augustinians, he was there for 2 terms, so that's 12 years throughout much of the early 2000s. He traveled the world, solving and dealing with a host of problems for any order in the church. And it was said at the end of it that when he had finished his term, that no one he had dealt with felt he had done them an injustice.
Wow.
And then you have the officials at the Dicastery for Bishops when he took over. And this is, again, no criticism of his predecessor, Cardinal Ouellette, who was deeply respected in Rome. But his staff had noted that he never loses his temper, that he listens to people. I think it was Cardinal Chomoli, one of the Latin American cardinals, made the observation that he has one mouth and 2 ears, and he uses his ears. So he listens, he consults, he tries to build not just a consensus, but really to make those judgments that need to be made, but again, based on listening and consultation and then exercising both prudence and temperance in how he goes about it. And I think those were attributes that were well known. And it's as the cardinals got to know him over the span of the interregnum of that of the Sede Vacante, of the Novum Dialis, the 9 days of masses, and then into their general congregations, you begin to see the wisdom of the conclave process.
Yeah.
Because in fairness, the cardinals didn't know each other. You know, they had not been together in any meaningful sense since 2014. And that's a lot of new cardinals. And when you factor in the 108 of the 133 electors were all new, had not been in a conclave before, they gave themselves very wisely the time to get to know each other. And it was in that setting that they really began to appreciate Cardinal Prevost more and more. And it wasn't, in 2013, Cardinal Bergoglio gave that 4.5-minute presentation of what the church needed. And that was the deal clincher.
Right.
That it was this memorable. Apparently, there was no such similar speech given by Cardinal Prevost. It was his presence. It was who he was in those meetings that they began to take note of the fact that he was taking copious notes of everything that was happening in the general congregations. He was listening to people. They just realized that this is the person who is ideally suited for this and that they all felt genuinely called to vote for.
Isn't that something?
Yeah.
So when he came out, we talked about the languages he used, but what he said about Jesus Christ and peace.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Were you able to hear that clearly enough to understand what was being said? And what did you make of his message? His first, like, this is like your big moment, and this is what he said. What did you make of it?
That's right. Well, the audio at times was a little difficult because you had reverberations in the square from the massive speakers. But it was clear, a couple of things. First, what jumped out to me immediately wasn't even what he said, but is how he looked. And what I mean by that is he came out in the Mozzetta. So yeah. He came out in what we always associate popes wearing. And again, this is not remotely a criticism of Pope Francis. He had his own very distinct style.
Yes.
And that was simpler. It was not being self-referential. It was his approach. Out comes Leo XIV wearing the Mozzetta, wearing the what they call the stole of the fishermen, the Gospels, the evangelists. And all of those traditional symbols that we associate with the papacy, it was all there. So just standing there, it was like he was going back. He was standing in continuity with the images that we've had of popes over the many, many decades throughout the whole 20th century of these the great film and other things of these announcements on television. So there was this immediate sense of continuity that spoke volumes to my mind. And then he starts speaking. And the thing that was really interesting is he was barely self-referential in his presentation. He talked about, I am a son of Augustine. But what were the very first words out of his mouth? It's peace be with you. And it isn't just as I've said in really since that first day, that it was not simply peace be with you. He was proclaiming the words of our Lord.
Yeah.
But he was also very specific that it was the peace of the risen Christ. And then, of course, he as a son of Augustine, what does he talk about? He leads us all very clearly, that is, that our hearts are restless until they rest in you. You know, inquietum cor nostrum est donec requiescat in te. You know, our hearts are restless until they rest in you, O Lord. And so he talks about what is authentic peace? And it's the peace you can only find in Jesus Christ. And then I was, by that point, already keenly aware of his episcopal motto. You know, all bishops pick a motto when they are appointed. And his is, in illo uno unum, you know, in the one we are one. And what it is, it's Augustine, his commentary on Psalm 127. And it's in Christ we are one. And so from the start, he has proclaimed Jesus Christ, but he is proclaiming unity in the church and bringing everyone together. And I think that's going to be one of the great hallmarks of this pontificate.
We'll be right back with more Dr. Matthew Bunsen on Catholic Answers Live.
It's all about the truth. Catholic Answers Live. Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects home buyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
Hi, this is Father Mike Schmitz. Please join me for Ascension's Bible in a Year and Catechism in a Year here on EWTN Radio. We're going through the entire Bible and the Catechism in 365 days. If you've ever wanted to understand what it means to be Catholic and allow those truths to shape your life, this is for you.
Bible in a Year and Catechism in a Year with Father Mike Schmitz. Tonight at 10 p.m. Eastern, 7 p.m. Pacific on EWTN Radio.
The Catechism defines evangelization as the proclamation of Christ and His gospel by word and the testimony of life. But what does that look like in real life? It looks like St. Paul street evangelists out in the public square sharing the good news. We're a Catholic nonprofit that starts conversations by handing out free sacramentals. Then we employ our method of listen, befriend, proclaim, and invite. Catholic Answers is supported in part by St. Paul Street Evangelization. Visit streetevangelization.com to learn more.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. I don't believe I have been rude to the callers. It's just every time I turn around to go answer the phones, they've gone. They've absconded. So obviously, terribly intimidated by Dr. Matthew Bunsen, which I completely understand. It's a ferociously intimidating presence. You don't feel that way? You're terribly intimidated.
No.
You don't really? Oh, you're.
Well, thank you.
I have to say I feel like I'm living those days and moments vicariously through you. I do want to mention the book again because Leo XIV, Portrait of the First American Pope. So how do you write clearly they gave you a quick deadline on this. How do you turn around a book? Yeah. I mean, you're the author of a lot of books. This is not new to you. You know how to do this. But give me a little...
And I did similar books in 2005 and especially in 2013 with the election of Pope Francis. And so if you've done these before, you have a reasonable sense of what you need to do. And one of the most important things is having a very clear set of parameters, of goals. You're not going to write a 900-page biography in a week.
Right.
Well, you can, but it won't be very good.
Leave that for George Weigel to write later.
Right. You know, at some point, it's worth revisiting a question like that.
Sure.
But we call it a portrait because that's what it is. It's a portrait of helping Catholics and people of goodwill everywhere to get to know him. To understand a bit about his background, growing up Catholic in a very important time in American Catholic history in the 1950s and in the 60s. What were the great influences on his life, from the Augustinians to Catholic social teaching, and then his work as a missionary? And then asking two really big questions. What was it that the cardinals saw in him? Well, we've talked a little bit about it tonight.
Right.
That prompted them to elect him Pope. You can imagine. And then where do we think, based on what he has said so far, what is the direction he's going to take us? And I think we have a lot of answers to that. And I'm very happy to say that since the book has actually been published, because it was published officially on the 22nd of May, that there's nothing that he has said that would really, I think, sort of demolish or call into question some of the conclusions we have. Which is a testament not to brilliance on any part of my part or anyone else's part, but because he's been so clear from the start of his pontificate.
I got to say, Francis was a dramatic figure. And people have very strong feelings about Pope Francis. And so I feel like people look, and I have to confess, I think I am one of these people in some way. You're looking like, Which team is he going to be on? Which is he Team Francis or Team Not Francis?
Right.
Is he Team Latin Mass or not Team? So you have these kind of goggles that you put on, and I feel like he's already done a miracle, which is he didn't give any signal. He didn't say I'm this guy or I'm that guy. He's so much his own guy, and some of that I have to say, like you talk about the Mozzetta, that he almost allowed himself. To to do the thing that he described in his first homily, which is disappear so that people can see Christ. And
that's right.
And it's not just rhetoric with him. It doesn't seem he doesn't seem to be a person who's critical of Francis. He doesn't seem to be a person who's trying to imitate Francis. He just seems to be a guy who's like, well, this is I'm trying to be the Pope that Jesus would want me to be.
He's not making us choose.
No, he's not. And I didn't expect that. I didn't see that coming. And I feel delighted by it somehow.
Yeah, one of the things that I really admire in Pope Leo is, you know, one of the questions that was being asked was, okay, so what's the new Pope going to wear when he comes out in the loggia? Is he just going to, does he feel like he has to just wear white and nothing else?
Because
we have, this is the new era in the papacy. He showed up in the Mozzetta. He looked like every other Pope, and it was completely natural.
It was fine.
There was no grand pronouncement about it.
No.
He just did it.
He didn't.
And that's how the whole transition's been. He has just eased his way into the pontificate. Like the other question, well, is he going to stay at Casa Santa Marta? Because after all, Pope Francis stayed there. It's his call. And so every indication is that he's going to be moving back into the apostolic apartments.
Yeah.
And it seems perfectly logical and perfectly natural, but he's done it without any fanfare. It's just that's what he does.
He doesn't seem to be a political creature who is making statements. All of his statements seem to be entirely in service to the church and to the Lord.
That's right. That's right. And even the little things, when he came out just a few days after his election to the Regina Caeli, and he chose to, instead of the window, because obviously I don't think the apostolic apartments were ready at that point anyway, but he came out onto that central loggia in St. Peter's, and the curtains opened and he came out and he was in white. This starkness, I may have commented at some point that he looked like a pope from another century. Just the way he stood there, it was this beautiful moment. And then what does he do? He sings the Regina Caeli.
I know.
In this beautiful Latin. And so there's this idea in him of continuity that, yes, he quotes Francis a great deal. And you can see that there are many aspects of Francis's pontificate that he's going to be building on. But he's also always talking about the popes who were before Francis.
Yeah.
So it's an and pontificate. It's Francis and Benedict. It's Francis and John Paul II. It's all of the popes. But then he's also very much aware of the Second Vatican Council and the Church Fathers. I mean, I've just been bedazzled by the number of references that he has to patristics. You know, Augustine we expect. But he's quoted Ignatius of Antioch. He's quoted Gregory I the Great, Leo the Great. And some obscure doctrine of the church, like Ephraim the Syrian. And Gregory of Narek. You don't hear that every day. And so he's building on this whole treasury, this great patrimony, and it's really quite striking.
It's also true that he doesn't seem to be an imitator of John Paul II or Benedict. He seems entirely his own man. I don't know if that's the right way to say it. He doesn't seem to be his own man. He seems to be the church's man. He seems to be the Lord's man. Looking at him, I don't, like you said, he seems like a guy from another century. He doesn't seem like I'm involved in all these modern, this modern bickering that's been going on. He just seems confidently Catholic.
Yeah, one of the ways that I think it was Corriere della Sera, one of the Italian newspapers, they called him un Papa Calma. So he's a calm pope.
Yeah.
And one of the words that I heard from a number of different directions in Rome was sereno. You know, he's serene. He's just very comfortable. And I think it's partly a product of his Augustinian background. He's at ease. He understands the mission that he's been given. In this case, by the College of Cardinals and by our Lord. He's, as a missionary too, he's somebody who is very, very adaptable to all circumstances. And that's a hallmark of a great missionary. And I think he sees this as the next task he's been given as a missionary, and that is to proclaim Christ Jesus now to the whole world. It's the embrace of that that I think is really quite telling.
And it does seem to be a moment, too, where there's this, you know, we're seeing reports in the media of why does everybody want to be Catholic now? And what's so cool? Mm-hmm. Why did how did the Catholic Church become cool? I saw that headline the other day. So right. I do think we're having a moment. It's not just Pope Leo. It's the Holy Spirit. It's a special moment. I'm delighted you have the new book out, Leo XIV, Portrait of the First American Pope. I have complimented you. I have said nice things about you, all to say of this criticism before you go. You blew it in one way. What you need on the air is a radio host. You need a radio person with you when you're in Rome. I've said this to you before. I hope you will take the criticism to heart. It's what America is calling out for.
it's the host America needs, right?
That's right. What are you doing over there? You all did a great job, but there was something missing, and I believe it was a radio.
It was
host.
You.
I'm not saying me. I'm saying in general. But okay, yes. If you're thinking that, next time you're in Rome. Right. I hope it'll be a long, long time before you have to ever have to do one of those again. I think you did a wonderful job.
Thank you.
But I long life to Pope Leo, and I hope you don't get to do another conclave for
as
a long time.
As the saying goes, ad multos anos.
Amen.
And I have to say, we're running out of time. It's always a joy to be with you. I love our conversations. I really do.
It was fascinating to me. It always is. Thank you, Dr. Matthew Bunsen, EWTN. The new book, Leo XIV, Portrait of the First American Pope. That'll do it for us. We'll see you next time, God willing, right here on Catholic Answers Live.